Well, these kinds of things I'm talking about are very different from the way in which our culture is presently treating death. Presently, we see death as an enemy. The medical profession sees death as a failure. The temple of life is the intensive care unit. The medical person is the priest. And when that became unacceptable, we then moved towards the hospice movement. Now, the hospice movement is extremely useful in coming back to a psychologically supportive environment, because intensive care units don't allow babies, they don't allow dogs, they don't allow flowers, they don't allow the human connections that give you psychological support. And the hospice movement was very interested in providing psychological support. And as such, it has played a useful role. And it provides a warm setting, either in the home or in a hospice residential space, for people to have psychological support and respect and dignity as a personality while they are dying. I want to support hospice and at the same moment express my reservations. Because hospice, in order to be fully acceptable into the economic structures of the society, meaning Medicare and so on, has avoided the spiritual aspects. And it has done so quite intentionally, actually. And I find that Cecily Saunders, who started the hospice movement, who I think is a very caring human being, still says death is an outrage. And I personally don't experience that. So that I want to support the hospice movement as a step in the right direction, but I want to say that we have a lot further to go in terms of what our possibilities are for creating environments for people as they're dying where they can have the spaciousness to explore the process they're going through, without being surrounded by people who feel sorry for where they are. Because, and what I have tried to do with Stephen Levine and his wife Andrea and Dale Borglum, a number of people, is over the years create a space. We've had different programs like Dial a Death, where you can call up and talk to people and have pillow talk with people to share with them the process of staying conscious through dying. We've had the Dying Center. We had one in New Mexico. My model was, was that I knew that my being with people that were dying, here's my predicament. I'm incarnated, and I have all of the stuff that goes with an incarnation. The deepest one is what's called first chakra, for those of you in those systems, understanding those systems, which is the fear of survival. It's preoccupation with survival. And I know that if I am going to work on myself spiritually in this lifetime, one of the things I want to do is work with my fear of death. And the way I can do that is by being around death during my lifetime. In the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, for example, they send the monks out to the cemeteries to spend the nights in the cemeteries. And in the tradition, they throw the bodies out there uncovered for the birds to eat it. So the whole thing is ecologically sound. And so you go out there and you sit with the bloated corpse, the fly-infested corpse, the skeleton, and you get a chance to be aware of all the process of nature. And you watch your own disgust and loathing and fear, and as I am now, so you will be. Prepare yourself to follow me. And it's in a way beginning to see the whole way that the body is decaying and meditating on decay so that you can find the place in you that has nothing to do with that by opening to that, because the denial of it keeps you stuck in it. That's the problem. Denial keeps you fixated. And that's why I wanted to get as close to the dying process as I possibly could. So the combination of the two things, one was that something had happened inside of me, which was a spiritual awakening, that made death feel different. And the second was that I wanted to work on myself and be close to the deepest fear of incarnation, which was the fear of death. That combination led me to start in about 1963 to work with dying people and to want to be available to them. Now, what could I do? I wasn't a doctor. I wasn't a nurse. I really had very little. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an ordained priest. So the question what I could offer a human being was that I've purified the way to say it now over the years. What I have offered another human being is a spacious environment with my mind in which they can die as they need to die. I realize that I have no moral right to define how another person should die, that each individual has their own karma, their own stuff to work out. It's not my job to say, you should die beautifully or you should die this way. I don't even know why, how they should die. Let me give you an example of that. I was helping my stepmother die. She was 69 or so, and she had developed cancer. When she developed the cancer, she and I were good buddies, and my father was 18 years older than she was. And so I was, my role was to be with her and to help her through this process. And she and I went to the doctors together, and we did the whole thing of getting all of the reports and dealing with all the emotions. Now, she was a very tough New England lady. She was a wonderful, grounded, tough, poker-playing, smoking, just fun. She was argumentative and tough and willful. And she had this kind of stiff upper lip way of living life. And so she was doing that around her death. And my job wasn't to say, hey, Phyllis, you should open to this. That wasn't my moral right. My job was just to be there with her. And I would lay on the bed and we'd hold each other and we'd just talk. And we'd talk about death and what we thought it might be like and all. But she was still very, very strong. But the pain of the cancer was very intense. And over time, it finally wore away her will. And there came a moment shortly before, maybe 4 or 5 days before her death, when she gave up. And now in our culture, giving up is seen as failure. Everybody says, you know, keep trying, keep trying. And we surround people that are dying with a certain kind of falseness that comes out of our own fear. When my mother, my natural mother, was dying, I remember it was back in 66, and she was in a hospital in Boston, and I would be sitting with her, and in those days I was taking a lot of psychedelics, so I'd usually be on something sitting with her. And I'd watch people come into the room, all the relatives and doctors and nurses, saying, you're looking better, you're doing well, and then they go out of the room and say, she won't live the week. And I thought, how bizarre that a human being is going through one of the most profound transitions in their life and they're surrounded completely by deception. Can you hear the pain of that? That nobody could be straight with them because everybody was too frightened. Even the rabbi, all of them, everybody. Everybody. And she and I talked about it. And she said, what do you think death is? I said, I don't know. I look at you and you're my friend. And it looks like you're in a building that's burning down, but you're still there. And I figure when the building burns, it'll go and you'll still be here. And in a way, we just met in that space. So Phyllis, she and I were, I was open and she could ask whatever she wanted. I didn't say, now let me instruct you about dying, because she would have. not accepted that. But then she gave up. And at the moment she surrendered, it was like watching an egg breaking and some being emerge that was so radiantly beautiful and present and light and joyful. It was a being that she, at some deep intuitive level, knew herself to be, but had never been busy being all of her adult life. And she opened to this being, and she and I just basked in its radiance. And she, at that moment, had gone into another plane of consciousness where we were completely together talking, being, but the pain and the dying process was just phenomena that were occurring. At that moment, she was no longer busy dying. She was just being, and dying was happening. And to tell you how extraordinary this, just to complete this story, right at the last moment, she said, "Richard, sit me up," because I'm Richard to my family. She said, "Richard, sit me up." So I sat her up. I put her legs over the bed, and her body was falling forward, so I put my hand on her chest, and her body fell back, so I put my other hand on the back, and her head was lolling, so I put my head against her head. We were just sitting there together. And she took three breaths, slow, deep breaths, and she left. Now, if you read in the ancient Tibetan texts the way in which conscious lamas leave their body, they sit up, they take three breaths, and they leave. Who was she? How did she know that? What was that about? I just want to play with you with the mysteries that I play with. Ramana Maharshi, who was a great Indian saint, was dying of cancer, and they said, "Let's treat it." And he said, no, it's time to drop this body. Because in India, it's called dropping the body. And you hear the implication of it, that there is something that drops the body. The body doesn't drop itself. The body is dropped. And his devotees started to cry. And they said, "Don't leave us. Don't leave us." And he looked at them with confusion. He said, "Don't be silly. Where could I go? I'm just dying. Don't make such a big deal. It's like I'm just selling the Ford, you know. It's not such a big deal. I'm just dying."